This weekend saw a cluster of losses on the world stage. Close to home, we lost Christopher Hitchens, contrarian, passionate atheist, and public intellectual. Farther afield, Kim Jong-il of North Korea passed away, presumably leaving the country in the hands of his youngest son. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we spend 30 minutes talking about Christopher Hitchens and listening to some of the interviews we've done with him in the past here at Wisconsin Public Radio. And for the second half of the show, we turn to North Korea. Well, our first guest this hour is David Frum, editor of FrumForum.com and CNN contributor. He's also a former speechwriter for George W. Bush and the author of Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. And we'd love to hear from you this hour. You can call us with your questions and comments, first about Christopher Hitchens and your take on the loss, at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And David Frum, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Well, you knew Christopher Hitchens personally, and at the end of the day, you had a lot of affection for him. What was your first response when you heard he'd passed away?
Well, we were braced for this. We've been braced for this for a long time. I was sitting at my desk. I was writing an article about a completely different subject, the Republican debate, which had ended on Thursday night. And I saw on my Twitter feed at about, I guess, 12:45, the news. And It was pain. I mean, you just, we've all had losses in our life, and they accumulate. And when you think about the people you've loved and who are gone, and then someone else you have loved and is gone, it is like a mallet hitting you in a spot that still has never healed. So I absorbed the news. My wife was asleep. I had to make the decision whether to wake her or not. I thought, there's enough time in life to have bad news. I'm not going to wake her. She can have 8 hours more without the bad news. And then I began to write down my recollections of him. And I hadn't prepared anything because I really didn't want to believe that this could be so imminent. I finished about 2:30, 2:45 in the morning. I heard my wife's tread down the stairs, and she looked over my shoulder and saw what I'd written. And then we opened a bottle of Johnny Walker Black, Christopher's favorite. And we had a little toast to him. Mm. I always thought of that. He would come to our house for parties, and he would walk past, the wine, and head straight to the pantry and pour himself a full measure. And we always joked that Johnny Walker Black in our house became the whiskey to have if you're having more than one.
Well, obviously, he was pretty comfortable in your house if he went over to the liquor cabinet and helped himself. How close did you get to him over the years?
Well, he had a circle of true intimates, the people who he had known from his Oxford days. I'm a half generation younger than him. And they were the people who, I think in the end, I mean, people like Martin Amis and Ian McEwan, that was, I mean, the great writers of English letters, of which he was so much a part. It was his most intimate circle. He had three children, very intensely committed to them. But he had a large circle of friends, and we were good friends. He was a frequent visitor here, and he and I did debates together, sometimes on the same side, sometimes on opposite sides.
He was a complex man. I think everyone who's writing about him now and who remembers him is talking about that as well, along with his tremendous skill at self-expression and his wit. He was also a difficult man. In fact, you even weren't so sure that you were going to get along when your wife said you got to meet this guy, Christopher Hitchens.
Right.
What do you think he'd want to be remembered for?
Well, I think he would want to be remembered for... I think what he would want to be remembered for are his essays, his contributions to the English language. I think what he will be remembered for is the example of his fearless questioning and open personality. I think in many ways, we were very lucky with Christopher because of the existence of all of these videos. He's means that we can preserve conversation. I mean, there are these figures in the past, like Oscar Wilde. I mean, Oscar Wilde, a great writer, wrote a great play, but from everybody who knew him, the impact of being in the room with Oscar Wilde was even greater than the impact of being able to read Oscar Wilde or listen to one of his plays. And we can have that impact preserved with Christopher in a way that with somebody like Oscar Wilde, we couldn't. That to that he was a great conversationalist, a Dr. Johnson type figure, where the things you remember most are the things he said even more than the things he wrote. Guys, I want to say one more thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned something about difficulty. You know, in the second wave of reaction to his death, there have been a number of people pointed out not only that he could be sometimes difficult to get along with, and that he was a ferocious hater and controversialist and had a lot of views. It's the people who loved Christopher came from every point on the political compass. I think when I look on his view, there are a few things I agreed with him about. There are many more that I didn't. I think the lesson of his life is how little that matters. He was wrong about so many things. He hated Mother Teresa, who was by all accounts a very nice person. He, to the end, admired Leon Trotsky, who by all accounts was not a very nice person. He praised David Irving, the Nazi-sympathizing Holocaust denier pseudo-historian who was proven in a court of law to have twisted facts. He thought John Edwards would make a great president. That's not what we remember about him. What we remember is his brilliance, his sparkle, his dazzle, his love of conversation, his openness to everybody, and his courage. His courage not just facing illness, but facing life.
Well, you mentioned that he had friends across the political spectrum. From what I've been reading, he also had friends across the theological spectrum, too, including believers who deeply disagreed with his positions on God.
Yes. He was intensely interested in God, in a way that I am a believer, but of not the most fervent sort. And I actually found that, Christopher wanted to talk about God a lot more than I ever had patience to do. it was a central preoccupation for him. And one of the things that I think a lot of the religiously devout found was here was somebody who understood that, who agreed with them that this was the single most important question in life. And it was the thing that as he felt himself sickened, I think he came to care about more and more, not less and less.
Well, he's probably in these last years best known for stirring the mud puddle on the debate between science and religion. He's known for his passionate atheism and also for his unflagging support of the Iraq War. It sounds like I know the answer, but did he have any changes of heart on these matters in these last days?
Well, on the Iraq War, he was committed to it to the end. He had a kind of unusual take on it. That Christopher always thought of international policy as a subdivision of morality, not of power politics. And so he and I, we agreed about the Iraq War, but we came at it from very different angles. What he was interested in was the situation of the people of Iraq. And one of the things that made it so made him so committed was he had spent a lot of time, he had been to Iraq beginning in the 1970s. He knew the Saddam Hussein dictatorship very well. He had met many of its victims. He had spent a lot of time, especially in northern Iraq. And from a human rights and human freedom perspective, that the demise of Saddam Hussein is such an unqualified good that he didn't look at it from the traditional foreign policy point of view, okay, this is a good thing. How much does it cost? There are a lot of good things that America could do in the world. And they have various degrees of expense attached to them. And if you're thinking about it from the American point of view, you debate, is this something that is good for us to do at the cost that we will bear? From the point of view of the Iraqi people, the departure of Saddam Hussein is pure gain. And Christopher was very involved and committed to their struggles. He knew them well, dozens, hundreds of friends in all parts of Iraq.
Well, we've done several interviews with Christopher Hitchens here at Wisconsin Public Radio over the years on our one of our national shows, To the Best of Our Knowledge, and I want to play a clip from one of these. This is Christopher addressing his political ideals.
Well, I've had various commitments and allegiances in my life. I wouldn't say that I wouldn't do them again. I'm not ashamed of them. Some of them I wish I'd done more about. But I've now reached a point where the group I'm most associated with, Richard Dawkins and a group of our friends, is a group that is united really on commitment only to doubt. We're certain only of the uncertainty principle. That may sound like a soft position to end up in, but in fact it's not, because in the present circumstances it commits us very strongly against the modern form of totalitarianism, the theocratic kind in particular.
A lot of people would of course, put a different spin on that, not just that you have embraced doubt, but that you've essentially joined the neoconservative camp when it comes to politics in the Middle East, specifically the war in Iraq.
Well, I think whatever word should be used for the regime change faction, of which I certainly was a member, I think neoconservative must be the silliest, because it's a faction that says we're prepared to make war on, to use violence against the status quo. I don't think you can call that conservative. Whatever it is, that's a radical position.
A clip there of Christopher Hitchens being interviewed by Steve Paulson on To the Best of Our Knowledge. What goes through your mind when you hear that, David?
Well, many things. You know, one of the reasons I think that he and I became so close, and we became our period of sort of maximum closeness came at a period when he had to admit to himself that he had moved away from the left. He always thought of himself as a man of the left. That's where he started. He started as a member of some Trotskyist cell in Britain in the 1960s. And whatever his reservations about the word neoconservative, that he had and whether he ever became of the right, he certainly had moved away from the left. And I got to know him at a time when I was, for completely other sets of reasons, and like him, at first without even being aware that I was drifting, moving away from the political right. And so we found ourselves often between two stools. I mean, still, you know, having some biographical experiences, you know, and not thinking that you were necessarily wrong about the things you had believed at the time you believed them, but thinking that they were not sufficient. He had a formula he used once when he was interviewed by Brian Lamb, who asked him about whether he was still would still call himself a socialist, and this would have been back in the 1990s. And he said, "No, but I miss it the way an amputated man misses an arm."
So he had, what is that? What does that mean to you? I mean, I read that quote before, and I wasn't sure what he meant by that. Does that mean he has some sort of phantom affection for it?
He had a phantom affection for it, which I think was misjudged. It also meant that here was something that had been an organizing principle of his thought. And it proved not only, socialism proved not only wrong, it proved inhuman and destructive. And that he was then, Christopher was groping for principles with which to replace it. He found it in the idea of universal human rights. He found it in the idea of in kind of resistance to, what was he saying, that item just there, theocratic totalitarianism, especially of the Islamic kind that is so dangerous in the Middle East and parts of Western Europe. But he never found a whole new system again. And that left him at the end, I don't know when the date of that interview was, but talking about embracing some kind of doubt, which is a funny thing for Christopher to say, because he was not a man for whom doubt was a comfortable companion.
I wonder if that left him somewhat adrift at the end there.
I think he was somewhat adrift in the end, but in a positive way. I mean, I think that happens, you know, that if the way you are not adrift is by joining, is by absorbing a set of pre-made thoughts. And one of the things that maybe adrift is better. And one of the things that I said in that obituary I wrote for him in the middle of the night was that as I got to know him, he was engaged in purging from his mind everything that was there that he had not formulated for himself. Our brains are encrusted, littered with all kinds of received ideas, things we have absorbed whole from others, and at an early age, maybe when we weren't competent or didn't have time to examine them for ourselves.
Well, and maybe that's the mark of a true intellectual.
Maybe. I mean, I think he was. I mean, whatever he was that is what he was. He was an intellectual. He was a literary man. He was a man of incredible passion about literature and incredible knowledge of literature.
Well, he has said over the years, and we talked about this earlier, some pretty controversial things. He called the Dixie Chicks sluts when they obliquely, I guess, criticized George W. Bush. One of his famous quotes about Mother Teresa was that she's a fanatical Albanian dwarf. Was this rhetoric, or is this the real Hitchens?
He was an English public school boy. And he was a creature of the English style of highly personal debate. He loved throwing abuse. He was good at it. If you can call it good. I don't know that it was my favorite part of his personality. It certainly got him the most attention. I think his hope always was that if he got the attention that way, that he could then make a serious point. And he wanted to make a point about, in the case of Mother Teresa, for example, that ameliorating the worst, that treating beggars is not the way that you deal with the problem of poverty. I mean, what India needed, and in the days when Mother Teresa came along and became famous at a time when India was not growing economically, I don't know that this is maybe now inserting my thought in place of Christopher's, but what India needed was to open the way to economic development and blast its way forward out of economic stagnation. And pulling beggars in off the streets and giving them a place to die is not a way to treat the problem of poverty. Poverty has to be dealt with by economic growth that takes not a few people into a comfortable place to die, but shows millions of people a better way to live.
Well, we're talking this hour with David Frum for the first half hour, editor of FrumForum.com and a CNN contributor. He's also a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush and the author of Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Talking about Christopher Hitchens, who died this past weekend, and wondering your thoughts about Christopher Hitchens. What do you think the loss is when a voice like that goes silent? And what do you best remember Christopher Hitchens for? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Armed only, this is my point, armed only with really one thing, which was a certain literary ability, as he put it, and a power of facing unpleasant facts. In other words, he more or less decided to refuse himself the lie. If I don't think something is true, I'm not going to pretend it is because it might be politically convenient. I'll see what happens if I don't lie to myself or others.
Give me an example of that.
Well, the best example we have is the argument about what actually happened in Barcelona in May 1937 when there was a civil war among the left. These are always, as I keep saying in my book, the most dramatic and painful of all is the revolution within the revolution and the fratricide within the left. And a lot depends upon whether or not this was triggered by the Spanish Communist Party on the orders of Stalin, essentially trying to bring off a coup, seizing the telephone exchange and various army positions in Barcelona, and using this to put down the left in a kind of pogrom. And Orwell said that it was true. And he said, I can't prove it to you. I can say I saw it. It's a book called Homage to Catalonia that's since become very famous. It was almost unprocurable for many years because people thought he'd just made it up. Now, we now have the archives, long after his death, both from the KGB in Moscow and from the Franco forces in Salamanca in Spain. And, as it happens, he was telling the unvarnished truth. It was at that point that he realized that many people could rewrite history even while it was going on, so as to make it seem as if certain events had never occurred in the first place. And that was the germ of his great idea for 1984 for Animal Farm. So all of that begins from this one piece of fratricide within the Marxist movement in Catalonia.
Christopher Hitchens, talking there, of course, about George Orwell. As we talk about Christopher Hitchens today, a few days after his death, with David Frum, editor of FrumForum.com, and the author of the book Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. And David Frum, he was an admirer of Orwell, wasn't he?
He was a tremendous admirer of Orwell. There are a lot of points of similarity in their politics. I think there's some conscious modeling on Orwell. He was also, like Orwell, one of the great stylists. I mean, it was said of Orwell that he was a man whose personality shone through every word that he wrote. And you would say the same about Christopher. I mean, you can, when you read him, you hear him, and when you hear him, you know him.
As we continue to get coverage, like yours, remembrances of Christopher Hitchens and summaries of his career, there have been some critiques that the media have been too soft on him, that they've been singing his praises and kind of glossing over the rough patches. What do you think about the coverage so far?
Well, look, Christopher never himself obeyed the rule, don't speak ill of the newly dead. So I don't think he can claim the benefit of the rule. But so I think we just have to take it on the merits. I mean, one of the things that I found quite irritating, there's a piece in The Nation by Kath Apollett, who had known Christopher well. They were colleagues at The Nation for a long time. And she made a number of claims that are – one of her claims, for example, was that Christopher could be a bully, which – it just strikes me as so unbelievably upside down. I mean, I remember we did an event together in Toronto. I introduced him and then was a questioner. And he took questions for – he spoke for 45 minutes, took questions afterwards, did a book signing afterwards where he took questions. And then my wife and I took him away and said, look, we're going to get you a chance to relax and take you to a place to have a drink. Now, I'm, 15 years – I'm a dozen years younger than Christopher, and I – work out all the time, and I was exhausted. So I can only imagine how he was. We get to the bar at the place where we used to have a drink and have, recuperate and then go to bed, and people start coming up to him and start asking him questions of this thing, and he engages with them. And I interposed myself and said, you know, Christopher's time to answer questions is over. The man has worked hard tonight. He is now entitled to some recreation.
Was this after he was diagnosed?
This is before he was diagnosed, but he was clearly, you know, I mean, the disease, I think, must be about 2006 or so. So the disease must have started in him. And I pushed people away, that he said, you know, I can never do that. And it's true. I mean, he would stand on a street corner and talk to students. Yeah, events would break up. He would talk to people for 2 hours. He would never deny people. Kath Apollett remarked that Christopher, you know, didn't become friendly with women. His friends were all men, and that's just crazy. I mean, that dozens of women friends, and not just in a kind of flirty way. I mean, he was a great flirt, and women, he was a very attractive personality, and women responded to that. But also, I mean, people I know who are very sort of intellectual and austere and who never engaged in that also loved him. He's not an unflawed person, but let's at least hold him to account for the flaws he actually had.
Well, you mentioned that one story when you were out together and he was answering questions. Are there any other stories that you're going to hold especially dear that you'd share with us?
Well, the one that always cracks me up the most, and it's the one I led with in that obituary, was he was taken to dinner at the Everglades Club in Palm Beach. It was a very exclusive club, notorious for not allowing Jewish members. In fact, to the point where a friend of mine who was a member there who had a Jewish wife was not allowed to bring her to the club until he made an enormous fuss about it. So Christopher is taken by a very grand friend of theirs to dinner there with, on the way in, his wife says nervously, now you're going to behave yourself. And he's seated, they present them with the menus, and he looks at the menu and says to the head waiter, do you have a kosher menu?
And he found out that he had some Jewish ancestry, didn't he?
Yes, I think his mother's he was actually, interestingly, under Jewish law, he would have been considered Jewish. It was his mother's mother who I believe was Jewish. But he found that out in midlife, and he said very touchingly when he learned it, he said, "I was glad to see that I was glad."
Well, before we let you go, I want to ask you one last question. What do you think we lose in the way of ideas now that we've lost Hitchens' voice?
Well, we've lost the discovery of where he's going to go next. I mean, Christopher was a man of change, a man who moved from position to position. The man he was at 62 and the way he thought was not the way he thought 20 years before or the 20 years before that. So I think we can try guessing where he would have gone. We lost his outreach and help to young writers. He was incredibly generous with young people. And so there are now a lot of people who are 15 and 17 who, when they were, who, had he lived 10 years from now, would have benefited from his help and guidance, and they're never going to have the benefit of that. Mm. And we just lost the joy of being around him. And for most people, when that kind of joy goes out of the world, we're talking about a dozen or 15 or 20 of their inner friends. But with Christopher, it's hundreds. I mean, he had hundreds of good friends. And so, and not just in Washington, and not just in New York, and not just in London, but in, you know, Baghdad, and in Damascus, and in Tel Aviv, and, in Benghazi, surely, where he would have ended up. I mean, there are people all over the world who knew that things got to be a lot more fun when Christopher showed up.
Well, David, thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been wonderful to hear about Christopher Hitchens through your eyes. I appreciate it.
Thank you for keeping his memory fresh.
David Frum, our guest for the first half hour of this program, editor of FrumForum.com and CNN contributor, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, and the author of Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. We were talking this first half hour about the death on Friday of Christopher Hitchens, public intellectual, a passionate atheist, and a contrarian voice that inspired many people.